you're here thinking that I will tell you all the answers to these topics, you're going to be gravely disappointed, so you should ask for your money back. Also, if I talk about things that don't make sense, please say something so that we can have a meaningful conversation about these difficult topics. Today I'm going to focus on two characterological or personality disorders. I'll be touching briefly on a third. I'm going to talk about borderline personality disorder and narcissistic personality disorder. The way it falls out in the way that we are broken people, a narcissistic personality disorder is most likely going to be found in men, and borderline personality disorder is going to be most likely found in women. There are some exceptions to that, but that's largely how brokenness gets divided between men and women. I don't know exactly when narcissism exploded on the scenes, but probably 10 so years ago, everybody was talking about somebody being a narcissist. And I was like, wow, how did that happen? And where did that come from? And I was like, can that really be true? One of the things, we'll talk about it more lately, is one of the protecting factors against narcissism is being in a collectivistic culture. That is a culture that values togetherness and doing things as a group. If anybody should be protected from that, it should be Anabaptists. But I do think there's some things in Anabaptist culture that promote narcissism, particularly among men, and can feed into that. And so there's kind of these competing factors that kind of feed into where that is. I'm not sure that everybody who is accused of being a narcissist is. Certainly there are those that are truly narcissists. Narcissists are often charming, gifted, confident, smart, strategic, compelling people. The more charming they are, the more damage they can do. And you can understand oftentimes when you look at somebody who is a true narcissist, why any questions about abuse of their wives or their children are quickly dismissed and shrugged off and doubted. Because they are such compelling people so often, particularly if they're charming and smart. I want to focus on these two because of the damage that they can do in a church. In a culture that values togetherness, in a culture that values that we do all things together and suffers well, narcissists and borderlines, people who struggle with those things, can create a great deal of dissension and division in families. They hurt spouses, they hurt children, and they hurt the brothers and sisters and who they fellowship with. They divide ministries, minister teams, they divide close friends as they try to figure out how in the world to best manage them and to take care of them. If your ministry team spends more time talking about one or two people, think about, is it possible that they have some kind of personality disorder? That's not always the case. They cause sleepless nights for those of us who walk with them. I'll never forget many years ago now, probably more years than I care to admit, walking with my first young lady who was struggling with a developing borderline style. It was my first one I ever ran into, and wow, was I having a lot of sleepless nights. Struggled to sleep, so angry with her mother, so feeling like I needed to protect her and that nothing was going right. I was in that stage where I was clearly on her good side. I had breakfast with my best friend, who's also a counselor, and like so many times, he speaks truth to me. He said, Chuck, you know, you're sleepless. And she's probably sleeping soundly, and so is her mom. That's the fun part about it, isn't it? That was a real wake-up call for me to realize, wow, I'm shouldering way more responsibility than I need to be shouldering here. But it's so compelling and so, yeah, the pull is so strong. Many years later, I was working with another young lady struggling with borderline personality disorder. And it probably led to one of my biggest crises of faith I ever had. She really wanted to follow Christ. She really wanted to be close to the Lord. She really wanted to do the right things. But her symptoms of borderline personality disorder made it really, really difficult to do. And so many of the things that she wanted, she just couldn't do. And she would come and talk to me about, why is it so hard for me to do what God wants? Why is it so hard to trust God? She would try, and her symptoms and her background would pull her back down every time she tried. I'll never forget the day she knew my sons, and she said to me, Chuck, can I ask you a question? She named my son, who was her age. She said, if he came home and said to you, hey, I'm interested in dating, she gave her name, what would your answer be? Right? She knew what my answer would be, and she wouldn't let me off the hook. And she said, why is that? The unfairness of that situation. She didn't marry my son. In fact, she never did marry. I still get to see her occasionally. She walked away from the Lord. She struggled mightily. Probably continues to struggle, is my guess, from what I get to see of her life. The unfairness of that, and my question to the Lord was, how is that fair? Why is it that some people, because of the choices of others, biology and other things, have a harder time walking with the Lord than some of us do? I don't have the perfect answer for that question. I do know that God's ways are higher than my ways. And in the end, the Lord will find his way through that, and that I have to rely on that and hold to that promise. But some days that's really hard to do. Some days it's hard to answer the question, where was God when I was being abused? This job has taught me that it's not my job to defend God. I'll probably mess it up way more than he would and does. But those are the hard questions that we face when we walk with people who are really hurting. I have a real passion for people with personality disorders because life is so hard for them. I read one time about borderline personality disorder that they are emotionally third degree burn victims, and everything that bumps up against them is against that raw burn. It'd be hard to live that way, to have the normal bumps of life feel so jarring and so painful against that raw, burnt skin. No wonder, you all, that sometimes when we say, how in the world did that little thing cause you to react so violently that we would hardly even notice against our skin, they react so, so strongly. Where does the term personality disorders come from? I'm going to get a little technical for a second, but not stay here long, hopefully. I should probably aim. Where do I need to aim this? Am I hitting it correctly? There we go. Personality, here's a technical definition. Personality disorder is a pattern of emotions, cognitions, and behaviors that result in enduring emotional distress for the person affected and for the others. That's really critical, you all. Lots of times, it's not the person who has the personality disorder that feels the most distress. It's those that are around them. It may cause difficulty with work and relationships. Personality disorders used to be called characterological disorders because it was thought that it was a struggle with one's character. It's an interesting kind of term that you could get from the scriptures, where it's something happened to the person's character. If you think about what in the world is personality, isn't that how most people experience us from day to day? We all know the personalities of those around us, or if we should, if we're relating to them well. Isn't it true that even animals have personalities? When somebody is not acting like themselves, we say, so-and-so wasn't themselves today. What are we really saying? They're not acting like their personality. Again, if you want to talk about the fairness of life, isn't it interesting that some people have difficult personalities that they live with for their whole life, and some people just have easy personalities? If you don't think so, wait till you have children. Hopefully you get one of those really easy children that just comes out and smiles and says, "Where's the crackers?" And when there's no crackers, they smile anyways. Just one. They make you look like such great parents. And you have to do nothing. Sometimes I think people that get credit for being good parents just had really easy children. Personality disorders then is when in the shaping of that personality, because again, personalities are interesting to think about as well. My sister has identical twins, which means that their biology is exactly the same, right? It's identical. But as they've gotten older, their personalities have become increasingly distinct, which is always amazing to me, because A, they have the same biology, B, they live in the same home, and C, they're always together. But somehow their personalities have become increasingly different. So personality is a mixture of who we are biologically and how we are shaped by our surroundings, both. So personality disorders are when that shaping takes place in a unique way that results in characteristic problems in relationships. It's different. So personality disorders are different than anxiety and depression. Anxiety and depression, you can see, is a more temporary state that one is in. But when somebody is struggling with a personality disorder, it's a problem with their very kind of core identity. Think about how hard it is to change your personality. That's how hard it is to change people that have personality disorders. Because you're no longer just sanding the surface like depression and anxiety. You're now getting the big equipment out and you're trying to round off really big edges that you can't do with sandpaper. It's also different than schizophrenia and bipolar, which are also long-term disorders, but in a very different way than in how one is at their very core. You can look at those disorders as a real shaping of personality, but in a radically different way. Officially, and again, let me see if I can get this. Wow. There are 10 specific personality disorders. We're not going to talk about all 10 of them. They're clustered in A, B, and C. I'm not going to talk about this long, but just so you know, A is considered the odd and eccentric personality disorders. They're just the people that are different. B is the dramatic personality disorders. This is where we write novels about. We're intrigued by them. We can't get enough of them unless they are in our family. That's where we're going to talk about today. That's where the two disorders that we're talking about. And C is the fearful and anxious type. So I would say that A and B, they are under-responsible. Those folks are under-responsible. They see everything as being a problem out there. People in category C think everything is within inside of them. Joshua yesterday talked about OCD. OCD is one of those disorders where people are overly responsible. The people that we're going to talk about today are under-responsible. They don't see things as being a part of them. To have a personality disorder, things need to be chronic and relatively inflexible. See, the thing to remember when you're dealing with somebody that has a personality disorder is that this is going to show up in almost every setting that they find themselves in. It's going to look different if they're really good. They're going to look different in their church than they are in their home. It's still going to be there, but it's going to come across in a different way. So it's inflexible. It doesn't change. Even when you think, oh, why can't they change? Can't they see what they're doing is not getting them what they want? Yes and no. Sometimes they can see and they can't change, and sometimes they don't know. Oftentimes, people with personality disorders, particularly in cluster B, have what we call an external locus of control. Locus of control is where do I feel the power to change resides, or the power to shape my life? If I have an internal locus of control, I believe that I can influence my life and I am responsible for what happens between me and life. If I have external locus of control, I believe that the locus of control, or what will change me, is out there. And if I have problems, it's out there. So you can see why people, by the way, researchers don't know what to do with Christians. Because we have this interesting internal and external locus of control, don't we? We have an interesting interaction between God, who has ultimate control, which is external locus of control, which, here's the interesting piece though, Christians who have that external locus of control, or that external locus of control, but also have an internal locus of control, God and I can do this together, benefit as much as secular people who have just an internal locus of control. And in some ways, I would argue that having that external locus of control, that is to put it on God, gives us a protection from even people who have just an internal locus of control. Gives us some trouble someplace, but we can look to God in a different way. And sometimes when tragedies happen, we can say what? God will ultimately work this out for His good. Which flips that locus of control. But again, in cluster B, they have an external locus of control. When there's a problem in their life, they're going to say it's everybody else's problem. Which is not great for those of you who are around them. The other thing I want to add here is that it is not just a short period of their life that they have these struggles, but it continues forever. It can be modified. But it never completely goes away. It can be shaped. But it's hard to completely go away. I think when they enter heaven, that's when they're going to get what? A new body and a new mind. And that will be removed. It's true for all of us, though, in some ways, isn't there? Aren't there some things that we just have with us forever? Oh, I went way too fast. Way too fast. Wow, how in the world did I get through 1 Samuel? Last thing that I want to talk about is the helper's reactions. Of all the people that you work with, people that have cluster B personality disorders will cause you to react like none other that you will ever work with. If you've never worked with anybody like that, you have no idea what you mean, but it's this feeling in your gut. And then you have all these bad thoughts. If you think you can control your thoughts and you never have bad thoughts about other people or evil thoughts, just hang out with these folks. If you still don't have any, man, the Lord has truly redeemed every ounce of your being and every part of your mind. Blessings to you. May we follow you as we follow Paul. So one of the things that you have to do is you have to guard your reactions. Guard your reactions. The worst story I ever heard happened in the news probably back in the early 2000s. And a therapist was arrested, and so I was curious what the therapist was arrested for. He was working with a borderline patient, He got his two friends to come with him into the session when she arrived. He said, today we're going to help you do what you've been talking about for a long time. His friends then grabbed her and held her down. He then slit her wrist and they held her down while she bled to death. You all, that is an awful reaction to somebody who has borderline personality disorder who is chronically suicidal. When he was arrested, he said, I was just giving her what she was asking for a long time, and I thought I was bringing her a sense of peace. Helpers' reactions to people who have, that's the worst, you all. There's probably not a worse reaction to have. Much more likely, you're going to be frustrated. You're going to feel the frustration internally that's happening when you're working. For those of you who are struggling with either narcissism or borderline out there, that doesn't mean you're a bad, evil person. That's the other thing that I want to say here. You have enough shame already, for those of you who struggle with borderline, but it is a feeling that results inside. Here are the 10 personality disorders, and if you look, we're going to talk about borderline and narcissism in cluster B. And I'm going to touch on antisocial just a little bit. I'm not going to talk about the rest of them. But you get to see, this is probably not in your chart, is it? I don't think I left this in your chart. So that's just a brief description of all of those. The one thing I will say, if we look up there, what is it? I actually don't know what it says on this slide. It's been a long time since I've looked at it. Borderline personality disorder, a pervasive pattern of instability of interpersonal relationships, self-image, affect, and control over impulse. We'll talk about all of those things. And if you look at narcissistic personality, pervasive pattern of grandiosity in fantasy or behavior, need for admiration, and a lack of empathy. Those are the kind of snapshot of where we're going to look at each one. So they're related, but they're very different in some ways. Again, I think a lot of times it's how the brokenness of these traits fall out in women and men when we look at that. Ultimately, I say that behind the borderline is a fear of rejection and an unstable sense of who they are. Fear of rejection. That fear of rejection and abandonment goes with them every step of the way. For the narcissist individual, they struggle with empathy and that inflated sense of self-importance. Behind that often is a fear of shame and failure. The more, though, I will say this, the more the person has that fear of failure and shame, the greater chance you have that you can help them. The less they have of that, the less likely you are to be able to help them. Does the Bible talk about narcissism? I'm going to read you this story in 1 Samuel 25. And I want you to imagine that this couple is in your church, or you're working with them, or you're on their support group. And we'll talk about this. If you can run the screen for me on this one, so I'll go that. For those of you who have other versions, I chose this version because of the words that are used in the description of who this man is. I'll interrupt myself, I'm sure, as I frequently do as I read. So, here we go. 1 Samuel 25. Now Samuel died, and all of Israel assembled and mourned for him, and they buried him in his home in Ramah. David moved down into the desert of Paran, and a certain man from Anon who owned property there at Carmel was very wealthy. He had 1,000 goats and 3,000 sheep. When he was shearing at Carmel, his name was Nabal, and his wife's name was Abigail. She was an intelligent, beautiful woman, but her husband was a surly and mean in his dealings. He was a Calebite. So we get to meet this couple. She is what? Beautiful and intelligent, and he is what? Mean and surly. mean and surly. And then it throws on there, you surely know this is an Anabaptist couple because they point out that he was a Calebite. Right? That is so good. And when I read that the first time, when I was old enough to understand, I thought, oh. So, talking about OCD, in my family, we blame this on the Zook part of our heritage. Although my mother, who was the Zook, she tells me that it's really the Yoders, not the Zook. It's from that strain. But we have this interesting version of OCD in our family. We were together. Some of the family was together at Easter. And so the nieces and nephews and the next generation below me was going around and say, how many of you have the Zook gene and how many of you wash your hands like a Zook? And so this is very fitting up here because they're not Zooks, but he's a Calebite. Which, you all, think about who Caleb was. That's the interesting piece about Caleb. He used it for good, whatever the Calebite trait was. Nabal, on the other hand, does not. He's mean and surly. Wow. So you get this couple. She's beautiful and intelligent. He's mean and surly. And then you bring in David to the picture. While David was in the wilderness, he heard that Nabal was shearing sheep. He was probably sharing sleep too. But so he sent 10 young men and he said to them, go up to Nabal at Carmel and greet him in my name. Say to him, long life to you, good health to you and your household, and good health to all that is yours. What a wonderful greeting, right? Now, of course, David is also looking for something. Now, I hear that it's sheep shearing time. When your shepherds were with us, we did not mistreat them the whole time they were at Carmel. Nothing of theirs was missing. Ask your servants and they will tell you. Therefore, be favorable towards my men since we have come at festival time. Please give your servant and your son David whatever you can find for them. So, David is saying, listen, my men, guarded your sheep and nothing, we didn't take anything. We didn't steal. We guarded the sheep at night. We were there at the day. We provided a service for you. So could you, it's festival time, you're having a big party, could you at least give us whatever you find in the back corner? Whatever you can find around there, could you bring it to me and my men so that we can celebrate with you? Reasonable request. When David's men arrived, they gave Nabal the message in David's name. Then they waited. Nabal answered David's servants, who is this David? Who is the son of Jesse? Many servants, listen, this is where he starts to go after David. Many servants are breaking away from their master these days. Who's he talking about? Saul. David is just a rebel. David is a rebel. Many servants are breaking away from their masters these days. Why should I take my bread and my water and the meat that I have slaughtered for my shears and give it to a man comes from who knows where? In this context, we get to see his what? His meanness and his surliness in this request. Can't you just see some narcissistic men answering in this way? Who is this man? This rebel? And then there's these pointed attacks. Now, some of that could have been earned. David's men turned around and went back. When they arrived, they reported every word. David said to the men, David's response is interesting. He's not Anabaptist. Each of you, strap on your sword. So they did. And David strapped on his as well, and 400 men went up with David, while 200 stayed with the supplies. I love the connection in the Old Testament between the supplies and the fighters. Oh, it's one of my favorite connections to talk about in the Old Testament. There was a debate one time between the supply keepers and the soldiers that went out to fight. Do you all remember this? The people that went out to fight said, listen, we should get all the booty, all the stuff that we get restored. Those people that just stayed with supplies should get a little bit. They should just get a little, you know, one peep at Easter rather than 17. And so they said, we get more because we went out and fought. And what did David say?
Equal. The people who stay with the supplies are just as valuable as the people who go out on the front lines. In the church, you all, we have just as much value when we stay home and we are faithful at staying with the supplies as those people who are out in the front line. Now, we can use that as an excuse, but there is value for staying with the supplies. I love that the Old Testament so often talks about the people who stay with the supplies. They get overlooked a lot. Anyways, that's just for free. Now, one of the servants told Abigail, Nabal's wife, David sent messengers from the wilderness to give our master his greetings, and he hurled insults at them. I'm sure that these servants had had insults hurled at them. Yet, these men were very good to us. They did not mistreat us the whole time we were out in the fields near them. Nothing was missing. Night and day, there was a wall around us the whole time we were herding our sheep near them. Now think it over and see that you can what you can do, because disaster is hanging over our master and his whole household. He is such a wicked man, no one could talk to him. Wow, that's a pretty direct statement. His servants are saying, now, I think they're a little concerned about themselves because they know that David's going to come and kill all of them. And so they're like, we need to be protected as well. But they're saying, this man is so wicked that you need to do something. Aren't you glad that Abigail didn't come and ask you what she should do? Can you imagine you get a phone call from Abigail? Hey, Nabal has made another person mad. I think we're going to be killed. Do you have any advice for me about what we should do? I'm glad I didn't get that call. But think about what Abigail is up against. How many women out there are in Abigail's position with their husbands, where they have to make a decision between the lives of themselves and their children versus their husbands? That is a terrible place to put women. Abigail acted quickly. Now, Abigail, I hope she had some servants who helped her here. Otherwise, wow, this woman could have a fellowship meal every Sunday on her own. Abigail acted quickly. She took 200 loaves of bread, 2 skins of wine, 5 dressed sheep, 5 seals of roasted grain, 100 cakes of raisin, 200 cakes of pressed figs, and loaded them on donkeys. That's a lot of food, you all. Now, David had a pretty big-sized group, but it's hard to just find that around in the corner someplace. David had just said, so meanwhile back at the ranch, David had just said, it's been useless. All my watching over this fellow's property in the wilderness so that none of his stuff was missing, he pays me back evil for good. May God deal with David, be it ever so severely, if by morning I leave alive one male of all who belongs to him. When Abigail saw David, she got quickly down off her donkey, bowed down before David with her face to the ground. She fell at his feet and she said, pardon your servant, my lord. Let me speak to you. Hear what your servant has to say. Pay no attention, my lord, to that wicked man, Nabal. You all, is she being respectful and submissive here? She is saying to David, don't listen to that evil, wicked man who's my husband. It's direct. He is just like his name. His name means fool, and his folly goes with him. As for me, your servant, I did not see the men my Lord sent. Now, my Lord, as surely as the Lord your God lives, and as you live, since the Lord has kept you from bloodshed and from avenging yourself with your own hands, may your enemy and all who are interested in harming the Lord be like Nabal, and let this gift which your servant has brought be brought to my Lord be the, given to the men who follow you. Sorry, she goes on. Please forgive your servant's presumption. The Lord your God will certainly make you a lasting dynasty for my Lord, because you fight the Lord's battle. No wrongdoing will be found in you as long as you live. I wish that was true. Even though someone is pursuing you to take your life, the life of my Lord will be bound securely in bundles of living by the Lord your God. But the lives of your... By the way, I tried to figure out if she did this on purpose. Look what she... Look at the analogy she uses here. But the lives of your enemies, he will hurl away as from the pocket of a sling. What did David use a sling for? No, only a boy like David, only a little sling. Abigail, that's amazing. Even in its prophecy, if it was prophecy. When the Lord has fulfilled, my Lord, every good thing he promised concerning him, and he anointed him over the Israel, over the ruler over Israel, my Lord will not have his conscience with the staggering burden of needless bloodshed for having avenged himself. When the Lord your God brought my Lord success, remember your servant. Abigail's wisdom and her courage and her negotiation here is amazing. It's amazing. If we could only have that wisdom when we speak, which we don't always do, but this response gives me hope for what you can do when you're dealing with somebody who has a personality disorder. How do we speak with that grace and wisdom, even though it's pointed? David said to Abigail, praise be to the Lord, the God of Israel, who has sent you. Oh, the other thing. Sorry. David's going to respond about this. I love that she says to David, David, do you really want this unnecessary, unneeded bloodshed on your hands when you become the king of Israel? Appealing to David's sense of justice. Is this really necessary? Do you really want people to say that once upon a time, David got mad at this wicked man in the wilderness and he killed 400 people? David says to Abigail, praise to the Lord your God who has sent you to meet me today. May you be blessed for your good judgment and for keeping me from bloodshed this day and from avenging myself with my own hands. Otherwise, as surely as the Lord God of Israel who lives has kept me from harming you. If you had not come quickly to meet me, not one male belonging to Nabal would have been left alive by daybreak. When David accepted her hand and brought what she had brought him, he said, go home in peace. I hear your words and grant your request. What a response. When Abigail went to Nabal, he was in his house holding a banquet like a king. Narcissism. He was high in spirits and very drunk. So she told him nothing all until the daybreak. In the morning, when Nabal was sober, his wife told all the things, and his heart failed, and he became like a stone. 10 days later, the Lord struck Nabal, and he died. In some ways, the story ends as almost too good. Right? How many husbands? No. Now, when David heard Nabal was dead, praise be to the Lord who upheld my cause against Nabal for treating me with contempt. He has kept his servant from doing wrong, and he has brought Nabal wrongdoing down in his head. Then David sent to Abigail, asking her to become his wife. And his servant went to Carmel, and servants went to Carmel and said to Abigail, David has sent for us to become your wife. She bowed down her face to the ground. I am your servant, and I'm ready to serve you and wash the feet of my Lord's servants. Abigail quickly got on a donkey, attended by 5 females, servants who went to David's messengers and became his wife. David also married some other people. Women, more accurately. But that was a nice little neat love story right at the end there, wasn't it? I'm not going to focus about that because that's not the point of why I bring this passage up. The point is the wisdom and the grace and the courage that Abigail showed in dealing with a very surly and mean man. That's amazing. I don't know what that means for every situation that we find ourselves in, but I know that there is wisdom to be found in that passage. But before we get too excited about that passage, I often think about that the scriptures that we read and we know in the New Testament don't seem to support that same kind of an approach that makes life very difficult. And I think a lot of times that the way that we need to work with people who struggle with narcissism and borderline traits often puts us in counter purposes with what we read in scripture. For example, let's look at 1 Peter 4, 8 and 9. Above all, love each other deeply, because love covers over a multitude of sins. Offer hospitality to one another without grumbling. Which says what? We should just give and give and give and give and give. Just recently in a session with a couple, and the husband turns to his wife. He mistreats her and some very painful ways. And he said to her, I don't know where your love is that you can't cover a multitude of my sins. Right. It's this passage right here. 1 Peter 3. It's a really famous passage, particularly for those of us in the Anabaptist circles where we value suffering and silence and suffering for the Lord. Who's going to harm you if you're eager to do good? But even if you should suffer for what is right, you are blessed. Do not fear their threats. Do not be frightened. But in your heart, revere Christ as Lord. Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give a reason for the hope that you have. But do this with gentleness and respect, keeping a clear conscience, so that those who speak maliciously against your good behavior in Christ may be ashamed of their slander. For it is better, if it is God's will, to suffer for doing good than for doing evil. For also Christ suffered for sins, the righteous for the unrighteous, to bring you to God. He was put to death in his body, but made alive in spirit. Sometimes I hear this passage being used that when we suffer in families, we experience and walk with the suffering of Christ. It's there, it is. But what's the extent of that? Jesus in Matthew 10 said this, anyone who loves his father and their father and mother more than me is not worthy of me. Anyone who loves their son and their daughter more than me is not worthy of me. Whoever does not take up their cross and follow me is not worthy of me. Whoever finds their life will lose it. And whoever loses their life for my sake will find it. Clearly the call to suffering is throughout the New Testament. What do you do when that suffering comes from the people you love the most? Again, I believe that Abigail's response to her husband shows that there's another way, but how do we do that with the grace that's required by the Lord and following him faithfully and experiencing suffering without pushing back? Another passage, another verse in Matthew 10 is this. Behold, I send you forth as sheep in the midst of wolves. Be ye therefore wise as serpents and harmless as doves. We are sheep sometimes among the wolves. And again, that's not to say that people who have borderline personality disorder or narcissistic personality are wolves. But they do bite. We are sheep among wolves in those instances. We need to be what? As wise as serpents and as harmless as doves. Lord, grant us wisdom and courage to do that. I'm going to shift gears a little bit and talk about borderline personality disorder. Wow, that clock moves fast. I'm going to get the technical stuff out of the way so we can talk about the good stuff, but this is the official diagnostic criteria. You need to have a pervasive pattern of instability. Can you move that up there?
pervasive pattern of instability in interpersonal relationships, self-image, emotions, impulsivity, beginning in early adulthood, presenting in a variety of contexts, and you need to have 5 of the 9 symptoms. Don't get lost into those, but let's talk about them. Number 1, a frantic effort to avoid real or imagined abandonment. Common triggers include upcoming separation. Worked with a young lady once. Her boss quit and moved on to another company. Boy, was that hard for her. She struggled mightily. She ended up with a massive downturn in personality, ended up, well, don't want to go too far because some of you may know more than I want you to know. But ended up in a very difficult situation. But that upcoming separation of her boss, who she had learned to really trust, just really pulled her down. This real or imagined abandonment is whenever they have a perception of neglect or rejection. Whenever people who are struggling with, women who are struggling with borderline personality disorder, when they feel like you are neglecting them or rejecting them, they will panic. They will panic. They are hypersensitive to any rejection in relationships. And oftentimes when they experience you rejecting them, what do? They get really mad. I mean, like really mad. And say some not nice things when they're mad. Their response is usually very out of proportion to the harm that they experience. When you have to separate from them, give them warning. But don't let that stop you from separation. When I moved back in the 90s from Michigan to Pennsylvania here, I was working with a young woman struggling with borderline personality disorder. She was the last person that I told was moving. I was moving because I knew it wasn't going to go well. She wrote a song about the occasion. It's an awful song. And then guess what, you all? She moved to Pennsylvania and moved 5 miles from my house. I was like, how did you figure that out? She said, oh, you told me you were going to go to work at Philhaven, so that, you know, there's only so many places you can move from Philhaven. Huh. She's also the only other person that I've ever seen in counseling who wrote a play that we acted out in a session once together. It was her telling me how bad of a counselor I was and what I needed to do to improve. Oftentimes when they feel abandoned, they feel what? That they're bad and awful people. It confirms to them that something's wrong with me. And their response in anger, sometimes I look at that response in anger, it's despair that they feel internally that they can't digest, and so they turn it on you. Because it's easier to put it on you than to feel that tremendous pain inside. The other thing that is interesting for me is this. So this is a person, this is a face of somebody that they've taken pictures of, and they took a movie of it, from somebody who's going from being fully happy over here, 100% happy, 10% happy, 40% happy, 70% happy. You all. Somebody that has borderline personality disorder is able to catch when somebody is fully happy at 48%. So look at the face that's 40. Just a little bit past that, they can tell this person is fully happy. The rest of us, we need to be at 69% before we know the person is fully happy. That gives them a 20 percentage point difference than we have. Not only is that true for happiness, it's true for rejection. It's true for rejection. They can smell rejection way before we can. I'll never forget one time I was working with a young woman. I'll tell this story later. This analogy will make sense, but she said to me, Chuck, I'm going to hang up. I was talking to her on the phone. She said, Chuck, I'm going to hang up on you because you're about ready to break one of your promises you made to me. You're really mad at me, and you're going to do something you regret,
and she said goodbye. I didn't even know I was mad until she got off the phone. And I'm like, how did she get it? I was mad. I was going to break one of my promises to her. She knew it before I did. Thanked her the next time. I said, thank you, Abigail. Her name's not Abigail, but the same thing. For needlessly slaughtering somebody when you didn't need to. Right? They can perceive rejection before we know that we're feeling rejecting. Oh, that's bad. They have little sniffers for the rejection that are so fine-tuned that they could beat a hound dog. And they live with that fear all the time. Number two. Pattern of unstable, intense interpersonal relationships that are characterized by being extremely idealized and devalued. What in the world does that mean? Some days, you all, they're going to love you and you're going to think that you are just heaven warmed over. The moon, you have hung the moon and the stars and they're bowing down at your feet. Don't be fooled by that. But man, it feels intoxicating. It's amazing, especially when everybody else in their past is straight from the devil themselves. And you all, when you hear about people that have worked with them in the past that are just really awful people, remember that's going to be you someday when they're talking to somebody else. Be careful what you believe about what they say about other people. They're not lies, you all. It's their perception of those people. I want to differentiate. It's not that they're purposely lying there. They're going to go from idealizing you to really, really hating you like few people can. Some of the most harsh, mean messages and statements I've ever received in my life have come from people who are experiencing borderline when they're mad at me. The number of times I've been threatened with death, dismemberment, being torn apart by wild animals of every kind. Sometimes by dear, sweet women wearing coverings. It's amazing. But you all, don't take it personal. I know it's hard when the people are talking about dismembering you, but A, it's not going to happen. Of course, if it does, I won't be to be able to tell you, well, Chuck, you were wrong, weren't you? You have the right to say that at my casket. But you have to figure out what you're going to do in those situations. How do you handle that? That anger is what? It's that despair and that distress turned outward at you. So they're going to go back and forth between really loving you and really hating you in a nice Christian way of hating, but going back from hating and loving you a lot. The other thing I want to say, when you're the helper and you feel like you're the only person who can help this person, be aware. Be aware. You have been caught in the web. When that person's life depends on you and you're the only thing that's keeping them alive, you're in trouble and so are they. Make sure that you can figure out what to do when that's happening. Walked with a young lady recently in my personal life and I watched her get caught in that web with a friend of hers. It's a tough one to watch. Number three, identity disturbance. Is that on the next slide? There it is. They have a difficult time of knowing who they are. I do think that Anabaptist culture helps a little bit with this one because the identity is somewhat restricted. And so therefore you don't have as big swings in the identity that you often see. I think where you see it more in Anabaptist culture is in their careers, in their jobs. By the way, their view of their support groups. Their support groups sometimes are beautiful things and the next time they're awful creatures. And it can go back and forth very quickly. I also see where they become this kind of very needy, willing to do whatever you want them to do, to being very righteous avengers of the past.
And so you see that fluctuation. But I do think that Anabaptist culture provides some protection from this strike in identity. However, you still get to see about what their life is like and all that kind of stuff. And there's other parts of Anabaptist culture that mask some of this a little bit more. Number four, impulsivity in at least two potential damaging areas. Again, I think Anabaptist culture helps a little bit in this. The most frequent things you see are spending money irresponsibly, binge eating, substance abuse, sexual behaviors, reckless driving, other things like that. And again, the structure in Anabaptist culture prevents some of this, although it's still there. You'll still see it. For those of you who are in the ministry, the Lord's blessing to you around this area. May the Lord grant you wisdom and grace as you walk this, because when you have a young lady in your congregation around these topics, around these issues, how to deal with that, it becomes very difficult. Number five, reoccurring suicidal behaviors, gestures, threats, or self-mutilation. In the general population, about 6% of adult women self-harm, that is to cut themselves or burn themselves or other engage in other behaviors that are not suicidal but bring harm to themselves. It's about 6% of adult women, about 17% of adolescents. Among women struggling with borderline personality disorder, about 95% of all of those women engage in self-harm behavior or suicidal gestures. That is a massive high number. About 10% of all people who struggle with borderline complete suicide successfully. Those are often seen to be as accidents. They don't really want to die, largely. That's usually the case. Suicide becomes a way of managing the fear of abandonment and their emotional response to that fear. Sometimes I refer to it, and don't take this the wrong way, it becomes relational management to use suicide as a relational management tool. It's a way to keep one attached to them and to make sure that that anxiety around attachment is not too much. Doesn't mean you can't ignore the suicide threats, but remember that it's a way of managing emotions. It's largely not a way to say, I want to die. Self-harm is the same thing. A lot of times they'll talk to you about self-harm as a way of feeling pain, feeling other kinds of emotions. It's their way of regulating emotions. It's not a way that I use, but it makes sense to me why they do, in a sense. Number six, emotional instability due to reactivity of moods. Intense feelings of depression, low levels of depression, irritability, and anxiety that can last a few hours and rarely more than a few days. Oftentimes, for the young lady struggling with borderline personality disorder, her main mood is a slight level of depression or dysphoria, low levels of depression, with periods of intense anger, anxiety, irritability, and deep sadness. A lot of times these feelings of these dips into deep wells of depression, irritability, and anger and anxiety are caused by that feeling of rejection in relationships and that feeling that things are going wrong in my relationship with them or with the other person. Number seven, chronic feelings of emptiness. This feeling of boredom that you need to do something to crank up the excitement is often the case as well. It's where they often get in trouble with doing impulsive things that they shouldn't be doing. Number eight, intense, inappropriate anger and difficult controlling their anger. This is usually expressed in angry outbursts that include belittling others, extreme sarcasm, verbal outburst, or persistent bitterness directed at their friends and the entire congregation of the people around them. These expressions of anger are followed by shame and guilt based on the sense of failure to control their anger. This is something I see a lot in Anabaptist culture, particularly given our emphasis on anger management and forgiveness, the sense of failure that they feel for the anger that they experience is intense, much more so than people outside of Anabaptist culture.
because we do value the control of anger so much, and these folks struggle so mightily with that control. And they often don't control it, for those of you who walk with them. Number 9, I'm not going to talk much about this, but when things get very stressful, they can become paranoid and experience dissociation, where they begin to feel like things are not real for them. Okay. Oh boy, what time is it? Let's talk about the causes before I open it up for questions. What causes borderline personality disorder? I'm not going to give you the complete answer because there is none, so just to prepare you for disappointment. I'm going to show you this chart, and I realize I don't have this chart probably in your slides either. Can you go to that next slide there? There we go. This chart does a summary of what I'm going to talk about. And so this is the best theory that's out there about what causes borderline personality disorder. So you have people who are, as you can see up on the top, that are genetically predisposed to emotional instability and impulsivity. This appears to be, from research, based on a low level of serotonin. We often associate low levels of serotonin with depression, which it loosely is, but low levels of serotonin are much more likely associated with impulsivity and emotional spikes than it is depression. When you take somebody who's depressed and you actually measure their serotonin levels, they're not really low. That's the dirty little secret. Don't tell anybody outside of here that. But then medications for depression still raise your serotonin. It's a weird thing. But what you see is that people that have low levels of serotonin, they are much more impulsive, and they're much more likely to have wild fluctuations in their moods. So the theory is that you have people who genetically have low levels of serotonin who result in this wild fluctuation in moods and impulsivity. The other thing that you see with people then who are born with borderline, who are born with a tendency to develop borderline personality disorder, is changes in their limbic system. The limbic system is the amygdala, which is the part of your brain that is associated with negative emotions, fear, aggression, and anxiety. It appears that they have a super sensitive amygdala that fires more frequently than other people. Which what? Triggers them to have this intense reaction of anger, anxiety, and aggression. In addition, their hippocampus, which is another part of, I always remember hippocampus, it's part of our memory and behavior management, campus memory. Hippocampus helps regulate behavior. That's also not as active for many people that struggle with borderline personality disorder, along with their cortex. Their cortex is the part of your brain in the front of your brain that is responsible for decision making. So I want to jump to this slide. So there's two tracks to experience emotion that we have inside of us. And so we get emotional stimuli down here. Let's say that you are outside and you're walking through the woods and you hear a twig behind you break. Generally, when you're not in a forest and you hear something snap behind you and you know that it's one of your children breaking something that's pleasant to break. I don't know what that would be, something. But so at that point, there's no fear. I know what they're breaking. They're breaking garbage down to put in the bags to take it out to the trash. At this point, you don't have hot emotion track. And so what happens then, that goes from your sensory thalamus, who's judging your emotions, and then it goes to the cerebral cortex, or the cortex up here in your brain. Then you can think through this and you say, oh, this is a pleasant experience. My children are helping me. This is wonderful. And then you have a slow but accurate processing of emotions. The more you can stay and do that, the better off you're going to be. Then you have this quick and dirty road down the low. So you're out and you hear the stick behind you in the woods and you think that could be a bear. Do we need to think about the bear, know what kind of bear it is? Do we need to know about that? None of that. All we want to do is run to not be eaten by the bear. And so that goes, it doesn't go to the upper part of your brain. It goes to the amygdala, and then you just do the fight and flight. You all, it appears that people who struggle with borderline personality disorder spend much more time in their amygdala than they do their sensory cortex. because of all this emotion surging through them all the time. And so they're making these responses way differently than you and I make responses sometimes. When you're with somebody else and you're emotional, you're in that dirty track, and so it's going to be not as good, and you're likely to do things and say things you wouldn't otherwise do or say. I refer to that as a red glass approach to life. The red glass approach to life is when you're always in this state of agitation and you're always making decisions, what? Out of this deep emotions. You have look at all these things. And so therefore, you are less likely to respond positively. So one of the things that we want to do with somebody who struggles with a borderline personality disorder is to keep them from being in this red glass approach where they're doing things in this emotional place. In this emotional place all the time. But that's where they go way more quickly than you and I do. So they're in this red glass effect where they're easily agitated, they get struggling. You all. We're going to get to this later on with narcissism. Narcissistic people also get here more quickly, but that becomes, they turn that into rage in a very different way than people who struggle with borderline. But they too make these decisions in this red part of their red glass approach of their brain, but they turn it more directly on you, and they make you feel little and small. But they too do the same thing. So we'll talk about this later and we'll come back to this, but what you want to do with both people is try to teach them to not make decisions in that emotional state. But it's hard to do when you're so activated, right? It's so hard to do. We'll come back to that later. If you have questions, ask when we have a chance. This is the fight and flight response. I'm not going to talk much about it today, but when you get into that, when the amygdala fires up, you get into the fight or flight response. And the flight or flight response is beautiful because we need the fight or flight response because all of those things kick into gear and we're able to fight or run away, which is also beautiful. The Lord made a great system here that keeps us alive, and it's a wonderful system. What is it like to walk with those who are struggling with borderline personality disorder? I often use this phrase, and if you hang out with me, you've heard it from me before. I try to imagine that I am a pillar, a center beam in a house that is being blown apart by a tornado. And my job is to be unmovable in the face of that tornado and to be as consistent and as stable as I can be in a house that is literally being torn apart by emotions. I want to be the same every day and not get caught up in whatever emotion debris is spinning around me. Is that hard to do? 1,000%. Because when the house is being blown apart by a tornado, you feel it. You feel it. You feel those pulls. You feel that tension. You feel the debris slapping you in the face. You feel the accusations about things that you know you're not guilty of. The accusations that are made, that heavy weight that you feel that the person needs you to live. The other thing you have to watch for is that you don't get divided with the people that you're working with to try to help the person. They're going to work really hard, not because they want to, but because they feel they need to protect themselves, to divide the team of people who are working with them. Oh, there's nobody better than getting ministers to fight with each other. Narcissists do it really well too. But they can get the team fighting with each other so quickly. Be careful how you treat others who are walking with the person with you. Give them grace. Give them mercy, even when you disagree. Because there's going to be times that you're absolutely convinced this person is harming the person that you're working with. Sometimes that's true, but be careful. Try not to believe everything you hear. What do school teachers say? I won't try to believe everything I hear about your house as long as you don't believe everything that the children report about what happens in the schoolroom. Be careful how much you believe. If the team gets divided, you're going to struggle more. Some of the catastrophes that have happened in Anabaptist circles in the recent years that I read about in the news that I haven't no direct knowledge of, there's a couple of them that were a young lady who I often wonder when I look at that disaster that happened. Sometimes where people have actually ended up in prison or another facing other charges. I look at the young lady in that situation and I think, oh, was that a young lady who struggled with borderline at the core of that catastrophe that happened in conservative Anabaptist cultures that got people to do things and to say things that they wouldn't have otherwise said? If you don't know the situations, don't worry about them. If you do, think about it. I'm not going to tell you about them if you don't know about them. The other thing that I want to say here is that one of the things that is the hardest for me in watching somebody who struggles with borderline personality is the intensity of feelings that they have for other people. Lots of times they're best friends. That one or two trusted people who they really trust, that emotional attachment is so, so strong. Just recently I was talking to a young lady and I realized that she has this very deep, deep connection to one other person. I just had a conversation with her. I said, do you ever get confused about the feelings that you have for that young lady? And I could tell by her reaction, she didn't answer me, but I knew that she did. And I said to her, I want you to know that those feelings are not sexual, even though they feel that intense. The relief that went over her face was amazing. But sometimes the intensity of their feelings for their best friends are too much for them. And they don't know what to do with them. And they get confused. The other thing that I want to say here is that they oftentimes begin to know that they become too much for people over time. And so some of them who have that awareness begin to feel that tension, and then they begin to say, I know that I'm getting to that point where those people are getting tired of me. And they get so panicky because they see it coming and they can't stop it. And that must feel awful. That fear that I'm going to lose my lifeline has to be really scary. Try to help them with that as well, but that's hard. The other thing that I, depending on how my relationship is going with the young lady, I often tell this story. My job is to teach you how to swim in icy cold waters full of sharks from the safety of my little rowboat. Does that feel fair? It absolutely doesn't. Because guess what? You're going to make me get in the water with you. Your one goal is to get me in the water, not in my little boat. Because you think it's not fair that Chuck gets to stay warm and dry in that little boat, and I have to swim in these ice-filled shark waters. But I say, you know what? I can't teach you to swim if I'm in that water with you, because we're both going to die. I got to stay alive if I'm going to help you. But you're going to do for a test of love. You're going to hold your breath, and you're going to go deep, deep under my boat, and you're going to say, Chuck, I'm gone. Where am I? Am I alive? You don't know, do you? You're going to tempt me to dive under the water just to find out if you're alive. Here's my promise to you. I'm never going to dive in the water. And I'm asking you, don't do that. Don't do that. But if you promise not to dive in the water and tempt me to get in there with the water with you, I promise that I will never let my anger get to the point where this is my promise I made to the person who said, Chuck, you're about ready to break your promise. I promise that when I am the most angry with you, I am never going to beat you over the head with my oar. Because because there's going to be days that I'm going to want to take the oar that I'm going to use in my rowboat and beat you with it. If you don't go under the water, I will never beat you. What a lovely thing to say to somebody, right? This goes back to the lady who was on the phone with me. Chuck, I can see, but here's what she said. Chuck, your oar is over your head. You're about to beat me. It was. But that doesn't feel fair, does it? That I get to stay in the dry boat and I'm asking you to learn to swim in the ice cold water full of sharks? I understand why the temptation is to pull me in with you. It only feels fair that I should be as cold and as wet as you are. It's just hard to survive when both of us are cold and wet. And I'm sorry that life is as cold and as wet and as scary as it is for you. This is a thank you card that I got from a young lady that I worked with who got to a really good place with her struggles. She sent this card to me. She was one that I told the story to. I told her that I think you went to a publishing company and asked them to make this card just for her. As you see, there's me way in the top in my rowboat. Look where she is. Way, way down at the bottom with her little scuba diver mask on. And I love what she wrote there. Look how scared I am. Isn't that touching? And a little jab at me, let's be honest. But that's really cool. That's what her life was like. How do we help people who are at the bottom of the ocean, who are scared to death? And they are. They are so scared. It gets covered up with anger and rage, and oh, it can be bad.